Look, man, if you're a genius, you don't have to be accountable for shit, right? That's the whole point. Hey there, party people. Welcome to People Stuff, a weekly anthropological advice show hosted by me, Michael, and my colleague, Dan. Dan, how are you?
I'm living, man. How are you?
Well, I am obviously still living, too. You have anything to add to that? You're just surviving? You're like at the lowest level of Maslow's hierarchy this morning?
Yeah, I'm like a little protozoa with my flagella out, just slipping along the primordial soup.
All right, well, let's just leave Dan and his flagella over there and get on with it. Remember, we're anthropologists and we know stuff about people, less stuff about protozoa, as I'm sure you can figure out. People stuff.
People stuff, not protozoa stuff.
That's right. This week, we're talking about trade school versus college, working in a factory, and truth in marketing for oil field jobs. But first, we look at something that's caught our eyes this week. It's What Fresh Hell. Dan, what's on your mind?
Michael, I'm so glad you asked. Have you heard of the Forbes 30 Under 30?
Yeah, of course. It's a famous list of people who are going to go on to do world-changing thing. It's the brightest 30 people in the world under 30 years of age.
Now, you've done field work in Silicon Valley, right? Like the 30 Under 30, it often showcases like bright up-and-coming entrepreneurs, right?
Yes, yes, yes.
Any famous people come to mind who have been on it?
Wasn't Sam Bankman-Fried on it at one
point? Yeah, I think so. I think so.
And there's another one. I can't remember her name, but she's been indicted for defrauding a bank in New York.
Is this the Blood Lady?
Yeah. No. I don't think she... Well, you know what? Elizabeth Holmes might have been on it.
In any event, there was an article in The Guardian where a reporter was doing some like back of the envelope math on the 30 under 30 list. And they came to the conclusion that the list has committed $18.5 billion in fraud.
That's it? I mean, these are the best 30 under 30. I'm surprised they didn't do $180 billion worth of fraud.
Wait till they get to the 40 under 40 list.
Yeah, I mean, this fake it till you make it idea is very strong and very, very compelling for a lot of people, right? Yeah.
It's just funny one because it's like, is this a better predictor of career success or criminal fraud? And it appears to be a pretty good predictor of both.
Yeah. You beat me to the punchline there because I was going to say, I'm not sure I'm going to draw such a fine distinction between career success and financial fraud because they go kind of hand in glove these days. But the other thing is like, if you think the 30 under 30 is something, let me tell you my story about the teal fellows. I was...
Wait. What's a teal fellow? It's like a light blue turquoise.
Well, a teal fellow is Peter Thiel. You've heard of him. Peter Thiel gives out these fellowships.
He's the vampire guy, right?
Yeah, exactly. For young undergrads, and I mean like 18, 19, to skip their first year two of college, drop out of college, and pursue a project they're passionate about, some sciencey project they're passionate about.
Oh, okay.
Well, I was once working in a do-it-yourself biology
how
lab.
How competent are these people?
Well, I'll tell you how competent they are. I'll tell you exactly how competent they are. Okay. So I was once working in this do-it-yourself biology lab in Silicon Valley, and this was, I don't know, 10 years ago or so, and the board of this lab was very excited because they got struck a deal with Peter Thiel with the Thiel Fellowship to have two fellows work there over the summer.
So in the universe of Silicon Valley, this is like a really big deal, right? That you're being blessed by the Vampire King himself.
Yeah, the Vampire King has all kinds of money and he freely spends it if he thinks he can he can extract some value from you. So they're very excited to have these Thiel fellows. And they're like these two 18-year-olds. I never actually met them in person, maybe just once, but I knew them because I was a volunteer at this lab this summer and that summer. And every time I'd walk in, I had the morning shift early in the morning and I would walk in and invariably I could tell when they had been in the lab overnight because they would work like midnight till 6 or something or midnight till 8 and I would come in at 10. There's just a trail of broken equipment and like messy reagents all over the counters and all over the lab benches. And my God, they broke all of the equipment. They broke an autoclave. They broke a microwave. They broke a scale. They broke several gel boxes. I mean, one night in particular.
Is this incompetence or malice?
Oh, it's incompetence. I just didn't know what they were doing. I mean, you could just like, we had another volunteer there had been a maintenance engineer at Texas Instruments in another life. And he was like a very highly trained, very, very highly skilled electrical engineer. And he was the guy who fixed and repaired all the equipment. Because, you know, you have this kind of lab where you can donate equipment. You need a fix-it guy. He's the fix-it guy. One morning I came in and he like walked me through this forensic trail. He could say, see, they started here and they broke the autoclave. They were trying to make something simple. It was like a agar solution. Okay. And so it's a very simple.
Just to be clear, presumably had you not dropped out of college and majored in biology chemistry, you would have learned this in like your first semester, right?
Like biotech 101, if you get in any kind of wet lab work, you're going to learn to do this. Yeah.
Okay.
In theory, you could have come to this DIY bio lab, taken an introductory course and also learned to do this correctly, but they are teal fellows. So, you know, they're geniuses and geniuses kind of skip to the front of the line. Okay. So this will tell you all about how Silicon Valley works. Okay. They had started in the to try to autoclave something, and they had whatever they had autoclaved, they had set it at too high a setting and they had blown up all their glass and plastic inside the autoclave.
So they created an improvised explosive device.
Yeah. They blew up it. Well, the autoclave is like very powerful and contains the explosion, but yeah, there was an explosion inside the autoclave.
An autoclave is a sanitizer, right?
Like it's a sanitizer, right? Equipment. You clean surgical instruments. So they were trying to sanitize their materials and. Oh, okay. So he was pissed because now he's like, now I have to take the stupid autoclave all apart again and clean out all the tubes and stuff and all of this. And then that hadn't worked. So they'd gone to the microwave and they had blown up their solution inside the microwave. And so it's like, now I got to clean all the microwave out. And then they had gone to, they had this scale where they were weighing things, but they had spilled some of the solution on the scale. And so it was all sticky and it wasn't working. And they had broken something else, which is escaping me right now. And there was like broken glass all over. And he said, I got there at 10. He said, I've already been at this, cleaning this thing up for 2 hours. It's like, I just can't take this anymore. And he quit
the next
day.
And they never like showed up and took accountability for any of this?
Who?
The Teal Fellows.
Look, man, if you're a genius, you don't have to be accountable for shit, right? That's the whole point.
Okay. What did they accomplish?
Oh, you mean like what was the outcome of their Teal Fellowship?
Yeah. What was the outcome of their genius and promise?
It was nothing that you couldn't. It was nothing that couldn't be easily replicated by a third or fourth year undergraduate in any R1 university. I mean, it's nothing. What have the Teal Fellows accomplished? I mean, not much.
Well, we have to see how many are in the 30
under 30.
But what happened
there is that eventually they were just there at the lab during the summer until they got more official lab space. They went on to some better built out lab that I'm sure they proceeded to trash as well. So
you know what this reminds me of? You remember in like World War II, the cartoons that they would have about saboteurs and sabotage, and it was the gremlins getting into things? It sounds like you guys deliberately brought the gremlins into the lab. And so you'd go home, everything would be clean, and then you'd show back up and the saboteurs had come through the lab.
Yeah, that's actually not too bad. It was a lot like that because they would always work at night. The other thing was like nobody's supposed to have keys to the lab. You're not supposed to, it wasn't 24-hour access, but somehow they all had access after dark, you know, after midnight they would come in.
Well, let us not question the wicked ways of the Vampire King.
Let us not. Let's just be sure if you have to deal with the Vampire King, bring a mop because you're going to need it.
Oh, dear.
Let's get to it. So, all right. Here's our first question. Dear Dan and Michael, I am a 17-year-old senior at an excellent high school in the suburbs of a North Texas city.
All right.
I have good grades, excellent extracurriculars, and an active social life. Not to overtly brag, but I am easily in the top 10% of my graduating class and have a spot at UT Austin waiting for me.
Oh, yeah. Texas does that top 10% thing, right?
Yeah, if you're top 10% of your high school class, you're in. Right?
Oh, okay.
Everyone tells me I should go to college, but I don't think it's worth the time and expense. A buddy is making good money working as an electrician in the solar industry.
Have you heard of the Teal Fellowship?
Well, I mean, he could get it if he doesn't go to college. I mean, this is
This person sounds like a thoughtful individual. It sounds like it wouldn't be a good match for them.
No, I don't see it. I don't hear the whiff of I don't hear the whiff of genius.
You don't hear grandiosity.
Self-referential myth-making genius in this question, which is really what that's about. So.
No, it's just like, hey, I went to high school. I did good. What should I do?
Yeah. So he continues. I heard that you guys went to college. So I did. And look,
wait,
what
have
it
we
did
spent
to
more
me.
Of our life inside of institutions or outside of institutions at this point?
I'm not going to think about that right now. But I heard you guys went to college, so I was wondering, should I also go to university, like responsible adults say, and accumulate debt, or should I learn a trade and start working? I know I will appreciate making money, but I don't want to give up on a university education. Signed, academically vetted, but vocationally inclined.
Yeah. Oh, well, okay. This. Yeah, I guess of all the people, we're pretty qualified to give some hot takes on this one, although I don't... I don't know. We might be a little biased.
But which way?
One quick observation. Like, you don't necessarily have to go into debt. There are ways to pay for college that don't require debt. I mean, if you are good at school or extracurriculars or whatever, there are often scholarships and things. But let's set that aside. There's a bigger question here. It's a little fuzzy in the questioner's asking. And I think this is typical of how people talk about college. They talk about it as this like this generic thing that you should just go to, and it's like it's an escalator into the middle class or a successful life or whatever. But I mean, there's been enough. I don't even know what you want to describe it as. World historical events over the last 20 years that have caused people to question the value of higher education.
There's also been enough academic studies showing that this escalator to the middle class idea kind of like goes more like this. Yeah.
I mean it. Yeah, it depends on the school you go to, because like different schools send you into different parts of the job market. And like UT Austin, honestly, is probably still doing just fine and propelling people into the middle class, if that's what you're going for. But there's a bigger thing here, which is like, why, what do universities do? And, you know, in kind of like the societal brain, it's like universities train people for jobs and send them into the middle class or whatever. But it's a little more complicated than that, right? I mean, universities can train people for specific jobs, like you can be a football player or a chemist, and like you can actually go and study or do those things, and it pushes you into it. But more generically, if you're not on a specific career path, it can mark you as desirable for the job market. Like, I'm the type of person that studied econ at UT.
No,
therefore,
no, it trained you for the job path because you're the type of person who can put up with a bunch of bureaucratic BS for 4 years, take directions, and somehow smile your way through it.
And you've been
domesticated. It trained you for organizational life, actually, is what it is.
It's like a domestication,
like
right?
Yeah.
I mean, there are these classic studies where, like, kids at prep schools don't get in fist fights anymore. Right.
Which is a shame. They should be getting into this.
But part of that is they've been trained that like the way that you're supposed to have conflict is you either suppress it or you write snippy letters to the New York Times. Right. You don't punch someone. And
or you start
Michael
podcasts.
And I are not necessarily advocating punching people.
Well, I am not advocating punching people.
Yeah.
Too.
But like part of what's going on with like the university training you generically for the job market and not for a specific profession is you're being socialized into putting up with the bullshit of the job market, the bullshit of producing CVs and resumes, the bullshit of begging your network for a job every time you're unemployed, the bullshit of not punching your boss in the face when you get laid off. Like it's training you to just take all this shit as a card-carrying member of the middle class. So like it can train you for a specific job, like, you know, lawyer, chemist, football player, whatever, but it also more generically trains you for this like professional class of life. But there's actually a third thing that it does that Michael and I like about universities that does not get much airtime and rarely finds political backers, and that it trains you how to be a good citizen, and it trains you how to think and how to learn. I mean, it's the study of the liberal arts and the cultivation of the individual soul, which
is really a romantic version. Wow.
Yeah. And then, I mean, then the other thing is that they're a rite of passage, right? Like, there's lots of different ways to become an adult in our society. Universities are one of them. You can join the army and go through basic training. You can go to a university. You can go to a vocational path, right? You can get married real young. Like, these are all different rites of passage to turn you into an adult. And universities are one of those. Like, you show up, you lose your childish affect that you grew up with, and then you get some independence and you drink a lot, and I don't know.
Do you think that's what you think university is, a place where you lose your childish affect? I mean, historically, like Ivy League universities are a place where you just extend your childhood for 4 years and explore yourself for 4 years. Isn't this the liberal arts?
I mean, that is class formation, right? Like, that is the pretension that someone who comes out of that has for themselves as an adult, right? They're a sensitive individual who can appreciate, you know, all of that society and culture and civilization has to offer. And you've studied the liberal arts, so you've seen a little of this, a little of that, a little of this, a little of that. You're cultivated, right? And you can sublimate that childishness into going to museums or appreciating the arts or whatever.
Yeah, I mean,
get the knives out, Michael.
No, I mean, I think you started out answering this question the right way, and then slowly, as you kind of bloviated about
professor brain
the
rot.
Romanticism of college, you kind of like ended up with this kind of, I don't know, let's call it a
vacuous
1940s, 1950s, very romantic view of the university as this place where people study liberal arts and read great literature and cultivate themselves. I mean, that is not
prior to the Cold War.
That is not the large public research university today. I mean, this public research university today is dominated by, you know what the dominant majors are?
Yeah, it's computer science and business.
Engineering, nursing. I mean, come on, there's all these. I mean, it's essentially a trade school, right? It is essentially a trade school at this point. And this is, it's a totally, I mean, it is a site of formation of sentiments, but the sentiments are very different than the sentiments you were outlining. But on this rite of passage things, learning a trade and becoming a craftsman is also a definite rite of passage, right?
Oh, yeah.
Trades are very rewarding. I mean,
and they're often more independent than the bullshit that you have to do
more
if you get a white-collar job.
That's absolutely the case. I mean, look, fixing something so that it works is very rewarding. Let's say when your plumbing is broken and the plumber comes and now your plumbing works, I mean, what's better than that, right? That's very good, right?
What was your undergraduate major, Michael?
Liberal arts.
And why did you pick that?
It was a different time and place, Dan. I went to a very liberal arts college.
It was the 1940s?
It was the late 1940s, and I had just been discharged from the army, and I decided to go major in English at a Midwestern liberal arts college. And then later I went to study this thing called to Harvard to study this thing called anthropology. Who am I?
Who is Geertz, comma,
yeah, that's
Clifford.
Right. That's right. After I got, you know, but so point being, you know what Geertz did before he went to college?
Yeah, he was a lineman.
No, he wasn't a, what is he like, the Wichita lineman out there?
No, he was like a telephone pole guy, wasn't he?
He was a lineman from the county and he drove the main road searching in the sun for another overload.
I think so, right?
No, he was in the Merchant Marine.
Oh, okay.
He grew up in San Francisco in like what is now Dogpatch, joined the Merchant Marine, and then went to college on the GI Bill.
I mean, for the record, my undergraduate major was classics. So it was ancient Greek.
That's even worse.
Yeah. I just like, I kind of despise the professional managerial shit that the university does. And I despise the idea that it only exists to produce people for the labor market. And, you know, I despise a lot of the bits and pieces of, you know, how you get a job, network, all that kind of shit. But I don't regret for one second my education, and I wouldn't want someone to miss the opportunity to get that if they wanted it.
No, I don't regret mine either. Mine was very much like I went to a liberal arts school that was an experimental offshoot of UC Santa Cruz, which was launched in the 70s. And when I was there, I mainly took classes with the original faculty who arrived in the 70s. And so... Yeah. Let me just say, this original spirit of the experimental liberal arts school lived on in my education. Yeah. And I don't regret it at all. But what I'm saying is that's really hard to find now. Those things have kind of disappeared. The university's changed a lot in the last 15 or 20 years, right? The last 10 years, yeah. Even. In the last 5 years, as COVID and ChatGPT has really changed kind of the course of university education.
You know,
so I don't, I agree with you that this kind of liberal arts education is still a very worthwhile thing, but I'm suggesting that maybe it's not so easy to get in the university today.
Yeah. I think we, this whole question has been kind of a spiral in us displacing our own desires onto what the questioner wants.
Well, I mean, aren't all the questions like that? I mean, but this one in particular, this is just more obvious, right? I mean,
well, I mean, you ask two college professors, should you go to college? It's going to... A little bit of self-loathing.
Yeah, look, I mean, so a big part of what universities do is credentialing. That's true. A lot of what people do want when they go to the university is to get credentialed into a popular high-paying field like engineering, a STEMy field like engineering or computer science.
Yeah,
so there's
a lot
of that.
Okay, so
that's a big part of it. Is that what you want? It doesn't sound like that's what the questioner wants, though.
No, the questioner just says his buddy's making good money working as an electrician in the solar industry. So, like, if that's all your concern is, just go do that. I mean, you know, that's a very specific career path. It appears to be in a growth industry. I mean, it's good money. Go for it. I don't get any sort of tortured scholar stuff coming through here. And I also don't get any sort of like status seeking coming through here. You know, I guess one thing I'll say is like, if you're going to go to a university, think about like, are you getting something from this that you can't get somewhere else? Right. So like, if you just want to make money and have a good job, there's lots of ways to do that. But like, if you want someone to teach you ancient Greek, there are fewer places to go and find that in the world. But heaven help you if that's actually what you want.
Well, I mean, if the question is he wants to engage in these kinds of discussions, you know, that you might talk, you know, I mean, because it's the classic, like, what is the classic romantic view of liberal arts school is that it's all seminar and you're sitting around arguing over text all day.
Yeah.
Which is,
you know,
which
I work
is
at a business
literally
school
what
now,
I did, huh?
I work at a business school now. And
oh, yeah.
Are you
arguing about Adam Smith, The Wealth of Nations all day?
That would be preferable. That would be much preferable. But every time the teaching and learning people come by, I tell them, I don't get what your fucking job is. My entire education is sitting around a table reading books and talking about it. And
oh,
unless you're going to help me
people.
Do that, go
yes.
away.
Oh, no, the ed tech teaching and learning people, that's a whole, I don't want to get into that. That's a whole different ball of wax. But what
do you see that on the podcast? You know, we're socialized in the professional managerial class, but Michael just got ready to kill someone.
I'm not ready to kill anybody. It's just I have been accused of not being well socialized several times in the past, and I was socialized into it, but just like it was kind of patchy socialization. Let me put it that way.
Opportunistic socialization.
Yeah, which is something about education people should realize. I mean, the person in the position of the learner has the final say on whether anything's learned or not. You can always, to echo back here to our previous episode, you can always refuse the lesson, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And so
yeah,
in many
okay.
ways, I did refuse the lesson of socialization. But what this writer can do is he can join our book club and our Discord server.
People Stuff Press, a subdivision of
Press.
People Stuff LLC.
Yes.
Yeah, so... God. Look, man, universities train you for specific jobs. They can train you for, you know, to put up with all the bullshit of the professional managerial class. Or, you know, if you're real careful about it, you can get this kind of classical liberal arts thing and take a couple years to think and read and argue. But I wouldn't just go to a university because everyone's like, yeah, you should probably do it. I mean, you should figure out, like, is this actually what you want to get out of it?
Okay,
and
I do actually have something practical to interject here. This what is it, the managerial professional class?
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
A lot of these entry level jobs are going to be displaced by AI in the near future. So
yeah, man.
I would
anything,
you know,
that writes.
Anything that writes like entry level professional managerial style prose is going to be those jobs can get harder to come by, let me put it that way. So
yeah.
My advice to you is go electrify the solar grid, and then if you want to talk about ideas, you know, join our book club, or you can always go back to college later and you might enjoy it more.
Yeah, you can also, you know, start book clubs with your friends. I mean, thinking doesn't just happen in the university.
Actually, the best way to enjoy university is when you don't really need university. That's the ultimate thing.
Because you don't have to put up with professors' bullshit.
Yeah,
you
can because just be you're like, not like, I mean, the people who enjoy it the least and get the least out of it, I think, are the people who are like desperate to graduate because they need a good job, right?
They want to go to med school and you are just a stepping stone. Get out of their way.
That hurts. It's too close to home. But yeah. That's right. I mean, the ones who like send you the 2-page letter of recommendation for themselves, they've already written. They've had written since they're like six. You know?
Oh, those are fun. What's our bottom line here?
Well, you can have your trade school and university all together at last. You can have it. You can have your cake and eat it too.
Have it all.
Yeah. I think the bottom line here is books. University is great, but it's really great when you don't need it.
Yeah. Okay. Well,
don't be in a relationship of dependency with the university and you will get a lot more out of it.
Okay. Let's move on to our second question.
All right.
Hey guys, just started working on the production line at a major European automotive company's manufacturing plant in South Carolina. I just graduated from high school and this is my first job. Everyone tells me I'm lucky to have a job in manufacturing, but I'm stuck doing some cleanup grinding on bolts, touching up paint, polishing cars, and doing quality control on assembled cars. The robots do all of the real work. All right. Also, the pay is bad and I have lousy benefits. My boss says if I stick it out, I can eventually move off the production line into management or learn to program robots. But he has not given me a timeline and the daily grind is, well, a grind. Is it worth sticking out? Should I go to college and risk being indoctrinated? What is the future of manufacturing?
Oh, all right. So... you know, there's a lot of romantic remembrances around manufacturing making the rounds.
Just like college?
Just like college. Is people romantically, Dan romantically remembers university and this idea from the 50s.
I don't think I'm romanticizing it. I think I want it to be something that it's not.
That is romanticization.
And that's the cruel optimism.
Yeah, the cruel optimism. Okay. Well, luckily, I don't suffer from a cruel optimism. Just a realistic pessimism. Okay, here's the thing about manufacturing. Robots aren't going away, right? Even in places like China, manufacturing employs fewer people than it used to, right? As automations entered factories, and that's why you're left with jobs like attaching windows and grinding bolts. Robots do all the precision work these days. And also,
why aren't robots doing the grindy or the polishy stuff?
It's probably too hard.
Huh.
It's probably like a little too analog, right? I mean,
you know, we should get a Peter Thiel fellow on this, right? A Thiel fellow? I think they could solve this.
You think so? By grinding the bolts themselves? I just imagine a Thiel fellow in one of those suits, you know, one of those suits that does motion tracking, grinding bolts.
With like
actually, you know what?
Balls?
I would not want one of these Thiel fellows to grind a bolt on any car I'm driving. Let me just put it that way, okay? Because I don't want like the frame to, the wheels to fall off or the frame to break in half.
You think you get like a Tesla situation where like the panels fall off and the accelerator sticks?
I think it would be worse. Yeah, I think it would be worse.
Yeah, I don't think they'd actually finish the job. I think they'd get bored and walk away.
My fear would be they would think they know better than the original robot programmers and try to reprogram the robots.
Then they'd give up halfway through because they couldn't be bothered to get through the entirety of the code base. Or they'd try and automate their code review.
Or they'd over-optimize their code and they would forget to do something really important.
Yeah.
But anyways, look, manufacturing jobs were once unionized and free of Thiel fellows. So, you know, you didn't have to worry about them. Unions had like a... You know, what happened on the line was a union problem, right? And unions were powerful counterweights to management demands. I mean, in your European automotive manufacturer in the South, I know you're not unionized there. So you are kind of there's a big piece of leverage that you're missing here.
I think the only time people are getting nostalgic about manufacturing is they're actually getting nostalgic about union jobs. I mean, A factory without a union protection is literally a grind. I mean, it is just a race to the bottom to squeeze as much out of you as possible. The union is the only thing that steps in and tells management, fuck off, slow down, and have a humane workplace.
Yeah, and it's also that solidarity that says, yes, what we do on the line is actually very, very important to the quality, to the way this company runs. You know, our jobs are very important. I mean, nothing says you're not important to the process like being non-unionized grinding a bolt or fixing a windshield, right? I mean,
you read City of Quartz, right, by Davis?
Oh, yeah. A long time ago.
Yeah, he talks about the Kaiser Steelworks, right?
Yeah, out in Fontana. Yeah.
Yeah. And like he describes this, I mean, kind of like, this is probably a bit of nostalgia as well, but a sort of a working class paradise where you have social clubs and you have all sorts of amenities that are provided as a consequence of having these unionized jobs.
Yeah, and that's the other thing that goes along with it, right? I mean, you're going to go drink your beer in the tavern after work. There's all these social activities.
Have a golf club.
A golf club, sure, why not? It's a way of life, right? I mean, it's a whole way of living in that used to be present in these big unionized jobs and these unionized towns. Because you know, some people talk about the loss of manufacturing. It rarely is it just, oh, my job, I don't make as much. It's usually like, this town used to be alive and now the town's not dead. And that's more than a job.
Yeah, it's not
right?
The job. There's like a mistake here. I mean, it's not the reality of whatever the hell you're doing to a Chevy Impala or whatever. Yeah. I mean, it's the larger social matrix.
It's the social fabric that comes along with a town like this. Yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah. And I mean, I think for that reason, our questioner, what did they sign off as? Oh, we didn't get a sign off.
If you're going to write us a question, be sure to include a clever sign off.
Yeah. 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 We'll call them grinding it out. What grinding it out is like accurately noticing is the absence of this community, the absence of the union, the absence of the stability, the absence of the ability to negotiate with management about, you know, work conditions so they don't suck. And, you know, that's not going to get fixed by having minor promotions along the line.
No. I mean, moving up to programming the robot is not going to fix that. Right. It's also nostalgia to think that manufacturing is going to come back to the U.S. in the same form it had during the 50s, 60s or even the 70s.
Well, the funny thing about that stuff, too, is that by a lot of measures, even after all of this outsourcing, the decimation of things like the garment industry, manufacturing capacity, like the amount of stuff we produce based on the people that are producing it, has gone way up
in the United States. Yeah.
I mean, it's higher than it's ever been. We just do more stuff with fewer people. I mean,
it's technology and cost structure is going to tell the tale here.
I mean, it used to take tens of thousands of people to run a steel mill. Now it's what, a couple hundred?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
And it's producing the same, if not more, steel. So there's like the localized job itself was made bearable, enjoyable, subject to nostalgia as a consequence of unionized job protections. And by the way, even if you weren't working a unionized job in the 50s or 60s, because there was like 30% unionization in the private sector in the United States, you would have to compete with unionized jobs for labor.
Yeah, and so, it had a halo effect on the price, on wage increases, right?
And yeah, it set standards really across the whole economy. Floor.
Yeah, set standards across the whole economy. I mean, you know, this is like, but this kind of trend automation is also in the way plants are designed today. You know, I mean, they're just made to be automated. So that's from the start. When a plant is laid out, it's designed and laid out for automation. You know, this is even in, I was just thinking about this. This is even in farming. You know, everyone complains about how many almonds there are in California, but you know why? One reason there's so many almonds in California is because you can harvest it with just a skeleton.
You get the
crew.
Thingy that shakes the trees.
Yeah, they just shake the tree. So this one person who drives a machine that shakes the tree, it's literally just go.
Yeah.
And then somebody comes along with like a big drop cloth, and someone comes behind them in a tractor. You pick up the drop cloth, dump off the almonds in a hauler, and then you just move on. Like three people can harvest the massive
tons
massive
and tons
blocks
of almonds.
And so it's like that. And that's one reason like almonds have become such a hot commodity in certainly California agriculture.
Yeah, and by the way, this actually does bring up a kind of a larger point about the technology that Grinded Out is encountering, right? Grinded Out is doing these things that the robots can't quite do yet, you know, finishing bolts, doing polishing, whatever. What you're going to see, because you live in a capitalist society, innovation is going to help capitalists. And the thing that the capitalists want is to rely less on human labor. And so there's always going to be this drive that is the point of innovation, right? To allow people to do things quicker with fewer people. So that's why we spend so much money on robots. And like, that's why we're putting endless amounts of money into these large language models, the ChatGPTs or whatever, right? The point of this is to have fewer people working and to have to rely on fewer people for industrial processes.
Yes, and it's been wildly successful. Yeah.
Wildly successful.
So I think the bottom line on this question is I think Grinded Out should go to college, actually, in this case, because a degree here is going to help them move into management or into robot building and robot management field or whatever the future factory looks like.
Or, you know, if they got a fighting streak in them, they could start unionizing. You know, they could try to organize and hook up with their local organizers, start a campaign. It's a hard road, but it's important.
That's true. Or they could go to college and learn to exist inside the big machine.
And have utter contempt for people that labor.
Yeah.
We're not giving Grinded Out a lot of good options here, are we?
Look, Grinded Out didn't ask for good options. He just asked for advice.
Yeah, I think like if we just take the individual case, like if you just got out of high school, you work in the factory and this is your response to it. I think at an individual level, you either got to get out or you got to change the environment. Getting out is, you know, going to trade school, going to college. Changing the environment is unionizing.
Yeah, that's good advice. That's good advice. Yeah.
Yeah. They're all real. They're all hard. But yeah, I guess that's what that is.
Yeah.
All right. Solidarity forever.
Now it's time for Fixing Shit, the section of our podcast where we come up with solutions for life's problems. Dan, what are we fixing today?
Michael. I've waited for some time for this. I think it is time that we fix professional sports in America.
What's wrong with professional sports in America, Dan? Also, I feel like this topic it could require like 20 or 30 episodes to fix.
I would like to keep up our unionization and the labor management dispute theme. And I would just like to suggest that the owners of professional sports franchises in the United States have way too much power. Think of the Washington Commanders under Dan Snyder, just a multi-decade vampire that sucked the life out of the club with no recompense.
Wait, Dan, do you watch football? Snyder no longer owns the Commanders, and they made it to the NFC Championship
game. That's what I'm saying. Once they got rid of him, the curse was lifted.
Okay.
He's a case study.
Okay, so it's not that you don't watch, it's that you watch too closely. Okay.
I'm saying, yeah, now he's gone. Look what happened. And this is a proof positive argument that we need to knock the shit out of these owners. We need to diminish their power over their little fiefdoms. And I think the solution is relegation. If it's good enough for the UK soccer, the Premier League, it's good enough for us. There have to be real consequences for when a billionaire owner fucks up. Plus, who doesn't want to see the Yankees forced to play double-A ball for a season or two?
Okay. So
relegation,
just for our listeners who do not follow English soccer as closely as Dan, relegation is when you have a bad season and you're relegated to a lower league.
And you think about what you did.
And you have to consider what you screwed up. Okay.
Whereas in the United States, for example, Major League Baseball has a monopoly, so you can't have competing leagues. And there is no pressure to relegation.
Okay. What would you do for like the NBA or the NFL where there's no competing league?
Well, there's the developmental league. I mean, maybe they have to go down and play college ball for a season.
Okay. So let's say the Cleveland
you
just, Browns.
You pick like a random ass community college and they get the Seahawks for a season.
Seahawks. Okay. So wait. I see how this works. So let's say the Cleveland Browns have yet another disastrous season and because of Mike Brown. And then they have to play in like the Big 10 or the Big 12 for a year.
Yeah, definitely. And if they do well, they can move back up.
They have to play Ohio State.
Yeah, yeah. And if they do well, they can move back up.
And if they do well, they can move back up.
My hope is that there will be so much shame embedded in this that billionaires will be forced to try.
And so then do all the professional players have to move down to the college salary scale? It's not bad for the coaches because the coaches will end up making as much money or more, as, you know, but I'm just saying. So
I don't want to punish the coaches for the depredations and failures of management. So I would like to keep keep their salaries about the same.
Do you consider the coaches part of management?
They're kind of like an overseer.
I mean, the coaches are by the very definition of professional managers, aren't they?
I also don't think these teams should have coaches. I mean,
well, how can you have a team without a coach?
Well, you still have a coach, but you elect them. And so, like, if your coach sucks, you fire him. I think that the players should be able to fire the coach.
Are you do you know about unionization in the NFL, for example?
Tell me more about the NFL Players Association.
Well, the NFL has a very strong players union.
Is that why they're going to be playing 19 games a season?
Well, they're going to be playing 19 games a season because the sweetener is that the owners have to share revenue with the players from the deal.
This is good. That's why I want more of this.
There'll be more money for them, sure. I mean, player salaries are up, but they are unionized. They've gone on strike at several points and have nearly brought the NFL to its knees. Right.
I just want a situation where you don't have like a Dan Snyder or who is the guy with the Oakland Athletics who took them to West Sacramento?
Al Davis. Al Davis has been dead for a decade now.
No.
His son,
the Athletics.
Mark? Oh, the Athletics?
No. Not the guy with the weird bowl cut who took the Raiders to Vegas. Hmm. John Fisher, right? He's the Oakland Athletics guy.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, we just have to have some sort of a ripcord that you can pull where you don't have a vampire who drains a city's professional sports franchise.
No,
its charm, all of its charisma,
Dan,
takes its withered corpse out to West Sacramento and leaves it to die.
Dan, like so many... I'm trying to be polite about this, but you have this entire problem by the wrong end. Okay. I think I have exactly the opposite reaction. More billionaires should own sports teams because it's a safe place to put them. Okay. Look, Dan Snyder, when he owned the Commanders, all he did was cause trouble for the Commanders, not anyone else. I mean, you think about somebody like Jerry Jones, owner of the Dallas Cowboys. What kind of trouble could that guy cause if he were unleashed in the world?
You know, there is a parallel universe where the NFL let Trump buy the Bills.
Well, that's exactly where I'm going. You know, in the 80s, Trump wanted to buy into the NFL. He wanted to buy the Buffalo Bills, and he was banned by the owners from buying them because they didn't think he was responsible enough to own an NFL team. They thought he would run the league into the ground. I mean, this is like the worst mistake in American politics in the last 50 years is the NFL owners not letting Trump buy in because it's a safe place to put him. He could just be up there in Buffalo owning the Bills, doing whatever he does with the Bills, complaining about whatever he wants, you know, and it would have been wonderful.
Okay. So if you accumulate a certain amount of money, kind of compelled to buy a professional sports team.
I just think it's a safe place to sandbox them away from the rest of society because sports are so compelling to these billionaire owners. Like I would like for Elon Musk to buy a sports team or Peter Thiel to buy a sports team.
So you think if he was part of the
Mars Avengers
group?
Or something, huh?
So you think if Thiel was part of the ownership group for like the Golden State Warriors, we wouldn't have gotten JD Vance?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. That's absolutely correct.
All right.
If he would own like the San Francisco 49ers or something, yeah, it would occupy his time.
You know what? I'll go along with this because what it does too is it introduces more competition into this ecosystem. So
absolutely.
It's not just this preserve where there are no consequences to your action. You're constantly getting new billionaires who are going to fight each other for status position or whatever.
This is the proper use of billionaires.
Combat.
Well, I mean, it's like symbolic combat through the arena of sports ownership. This is what billionaires should be doing. They should be doing this. They should be spending all of their time, all of their energy, and most of their money on sports teams. It's a safe sandbox for them.
What do we do with the Green Bay Packers?
Well, the Green Bay Packers are like an outlier, right? I mean, it's a community-owned team. It's really kind of amazing. You can buy a share of the Green Bay Packers.
And that's incredible. Really,
it's an incredible situation.
They're never going to leave Green Bay. They always try and field a competitive team.
They always do. Yeah, they're always competitive. They're good. They've been good the last few years, and it looks like they're going to be even better this year. So
I guess we have two paths here. If we actually want to solve the sports problem, we got to get rid of the fucking billionaires and go to some sort of a community thing with more competition. But if you want to solve the sports problem,
Green Bay, the Green Bay Packers model is the way to go.
But if you want to solve the billionaire problem,
yeah,
short of guillotines,
then the Oakland Raiders model, you know, Carolina Panthers model is the way to go.
Yeah, just warehouse them somewhere.
Look at that, like, hedge fund owner whose name escapes me, who bought the Carolina Panthers. He's run that team into the ground by his meddling, constant meddling in the management of the team.
I think James Dolan is set to do that again with the Knicks.
Oh yeah, absolutely. I'm saying is, like, you know, billionaires are dangerous. They're like fire. They're dangerous. I mean, look at what Elon Musk has done in the last 6 months with this Doge business. He's just caused upturned a lot of Apple cars. Look at what the Teal Fellows did in miniature in this lab. You know, it's a disaster. They need to be sandboxed off from society where they can't do any more damage than they've already done. And professional sports is that sandbox.
I mean, James Dolan's an interesting case because, like, you have to imagine that if you put him in, like, a mid-level position in the Department of Defense, we probably already would have bombed Panama. But left to his own devices, he gets to fire coaches of the Knicks and force bands to allow his band to do opening gigs for him at the Garden.
Exactly. It keeps him off the street.
Because
You know what it does? It keeps them out of politics in a really overt way.
I like that. I like that a lot.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, there you have it.
And also, if you play this right, there could be a couple more Green Bay Packers style teams, and you could just pit the people versus the billionaires. And that's an even better made for TV.
You know what
kind of
I think
battle.
We should do? Okay. You get a certain amount of money, you're forced to buy a professional sports team.
Yes.
And, you know, there's all sorts of societal inducements to force you to pay attention to it and not cause mischief elsewhere.
Right.
But there is a sunset for your ownership. Perhaps upon your death, it converts into a community buyout.
But what are you going to do with the billionaire's children then? That's the problem.
Well, they'll have to buy their own sports team when they come into their inheritance.
Well, there's going to be nothing but sports teams in this world.
Do you have any
that.
Idea how much Americans like sports?
Yeah, a lot. That's true. You know what? It's been a while since we've had a new sport. Maybe we can have new sports introduced, you know?
Yeah, man. One of these billionaires is going to want to make their mark, and I would love it to not be on the Department of Education.
The problem is that there's more billionaires.
The wrestling lady. She's running the Department of Education.
Yeah. You know, I would like her a lot more as the owner of the Buffalo Bills.
Yes. Or if she just stuck to the fucking WWE.
Yeah, she already has a sports league.
Yeah, she's grown bored with it or something. I don't know.
Yeah. No, but this is the proper use of billionaires.
Yeah. Expensive symbolic combat.
Exactly.
All right. Well, I think we fixed sports.
Oh, yeah. We definitely fixed sports. I feel like we've done good work here. We're going to take a break now. And when we get back, we've got one more question.
In our age of social breakdown, digital overload, and ever-accelerating assaults on reality, do you worry there's not enough humanity in your life? People Stuff is here to help. As cultural anthropologists, Dan and Michael have noticed that our institutions are failing us. Whether it's a cookie-cutter wedding, a funeral that leaves everyone confused and sadder than when they started, or a bar mitzvah, quinceañera, or sweet 16 that leaves no one feeling like an adult, these important moments in our lives are getting away from us. It's not just at home. Who hasn't been alienated by an awkward HR department or soul-crushing job search? What politician hasn't come off as inauthentic? What sports team hasn't replicated the worst tendencies of the social media age? And what school isn't at its wit's end due to the rise of AI? As anthropologists, Dan and Michael are ritual specialists, and they can bring meaning back into your life. If you see yourself in any of this, reach out to us at people-stuff.com. We'd love to hear from you. We'll talk to you human to human, learn about your situation, and plan out a customized ritual to suit your needs. People Stuff. We know stuff about people.
All right, our last question. Longtime listener, first-time asker here. I am a 31-year-old woman working in human resources for a small oil well service company in Bakersfield. Don't start with me about working in the oil industry, Dan. It pays the bills.
Hey, man. I was just pumped about Bakersfield.
Are you also a fan of Bakersfield? I thought I was the only one.
You know, as a child, I had to go there a lot and I didn't like it. But as an adult, I've come to appreciate how weird it was. My grandpa built hot rods and he'd go to car shows there. And so we'd go with him to these car shows in Bakersfield.
Like Fontana.
And then we'd get... Yeah,
I went to the Fontana Drags as a kid. And I didn't really like Bakersfield when I was a kid, but I have to drive up 99 on a regular basis these days. And I always stop to eat in Bakersfield. Bakersfield is a very underrated food town.
We would always go to Basque restaurants when we were there.
Yeah, like the Pyrenees Cafe.
That's the first place I had cow tongue.
Yes, shout out to Pyrenees Cafe. Luigi's, the second oldest Italian deli in California's downtown, not far from the Pyrenees Cafe. 24th Street Cafe, also good. And last time I was there, I ate at Mexicali, which is like the oldest Mexican restaurant in the U.S.
It's
where
incredible.
I saw the guy from Notorious Bakersfield podcast. Shout out to Notorious Bakersfield podcast.
Okay. Well, more gushing about Bakersfield will proceed, I assume, as we answer this question.
Yeah. Well, this answer will definitely contain a reference to Merle Haggard and or Buck Owens. I guarantee you that. Okay. So here we go. Okay. Anyway, my problem is that when we hire people to service the pump jacks, we have an extremely high turnover rate of 90% per year. The average in our industry is around 60%. When I conduct exit interviews with exiting employees, they tell me the job description does not match the job's day-to-day work. They don't want to work hard, they don't want to get dirty, they think it is too hot, and they don't want to breathe in oil vapors all day. I have rewritten and rewritten our job ads, but if I don't fix this soon, I might be turned over. What is going on, and how do I fix this problem? Signed, Overbaked.
So, okay, let's just start with some preliminaries here. I just want to assume some things before we get into this. And Michael, you can mock me mercilessly if these assumptions are unwarranted. But
I absolutely will, Dan.
I just want to start off assuming that there's nothing misleading in the job advertisement, right? Like it's a normal job advertisement. It says as much or as little about a job as any other job advertisement.
I mean, how can you be misleading about servicing a pump jack?
Yeah, like I'm just gonna go out on a limb. I mean, I don't know. Maybe they give something about like how quickly you'll move up the ranks, or like, you know, air conditioned conditions when you're not on the pump jack, or whatever. Like, let's just assume there's not any of that bullshit. I'm also gonna assume that the pay is fine, the benefits are adequate, scheduling's reasonable. I know these aren't necessarily reasonable, but like if these are the issues, they're pretty simple to solve, right? Pay people more. Better benefits, don't schedule like a psychopath.
You think those are easy to solve?
I don't know if they're easy or hard to solve. I don't know what this company's like, but like,
okay.
It's not like some magical, mystical anthropology shit to pay someone more money.
No, it can't be some magical, mystical business shit to pay someone more money, though.
Well, it's probably because you have the ethos of the teal fellow to contend with.
I mean, inhabited, yeah.
Yeah. I'm also going to assume that, like, there are normal levels of danger in the job. Management and supervision is competent and creates a warm and welcoming work environment, right? Laugh me off the podcast. I get that. But, like, if these are the issues, right, if you have an unsafe work environment, like, for whatever, you know, doing this work is, if management are hostile assholes, like, if those are your problems, like, an anthropology advice podcast is not going to give you some magical way to solve it. You have to have managers who aren't assholes and treat their employees like humans. Like, that has to be part of it. And we don't get anything in the question to suggest that, like, this shit is going on at the company. Like, I'm just imagining my way through the preliminaries that, like, okay, if this is your problem, like, that's what you have to do to
solve
it.
Well, I mean, she does say the turnover rate is 30% higher than the industry average. I mean, how these things are calculated, I have no idea. But, That does seem like it.
Yeah, so maybe there is something with the workplace, right? You know, if people are quitting because the foreman refuses to shower and berates their employees, well, like, There's your problem.
I have a much simpler take on this question. I mean, I think what the questioner has run afoul of here is what's called the shop floor problem. In a nutshell, no formal description of work can possibly capture the embodied everyday nature of that work. Let me explain. I'm going to give you a very practical how-to example of how to write this job description, what you need to do to write an adequate job description that will take into account all of these things. Because if, in fact, let's assume Dan's wrong and that you know, you have some kind of terrible management and low pay. Okay, you still have this turnover problem. In theory, you could hire people who would accept that and they wouldn't leave, right? You could, this turnover problem can be, because it's the turnover that's the problem, right? So let me explain how to write a job description. So in the 1960s, Harold Garfinkel gave some undergraduate students homework.
This is going to be your simplification. You're going to give them some right. Harold Garfinkel.
Yeah, that's right. Okay. That's right. Okay. That's right. When in need, Garfinkel is there for you, Dan. Okay. He gave
people
homework.
People stuffers,
in the
do yourself a favor and go Google Harold Garfinkel and read a little bit of it.
Don't do that. There's no need to Google Harold Garfinkel. Just listen to my soothing voice as I explain what to do here. That's all you have to do. And definitely don't try to read anything he wrote. Don't do that.
But yes,
okay?
Michael will simplify things for us. Go ahead, Michael. Simplify.
Ugh. You give me a headache, Dan. Okay. Anyways, this homework was called breaching experiments. Basically, he asked students to go to restaurants and pretend not to know what a restaurant is or what a waiter was or how service works.
Basically, pretend to be a teal fellow.
Kind of, yeah. Or to have everyday conversations with their housemates and pretend not to know common terms and concepts like couches or tables or things like this. Okay. As you can imagine, this study was...
Well, the teal fellows know what a couch is because they're all couch fuckers.
Yeah, they do know what the couch is. And yeah, this is a wildly stressful kind of thing to do. But the idea behind it is very simple and very powerful. And it's to discover the tacit knowledge and rules of a social situation, whether that be maintaining a pump jack, being a teal fellow, or just having a conversation over dinner. So here, if you want to write an adequate description, join the pump jack crew for a few days and pretend not to know the meaning of common terms or how to use tools, or maybe not even how to drive, maybe even pretend not to know what a pump jack is or how the oil business works.
Michael, do you want the turnover rate to be even higher?
No, you do this a couple of days, right? In this way, you're going to learn a lot about the tacit knowledge and skills required, because you're going to be instructed in exactly what it takes to do this job. And with this knowledge, you'll be able to write a fantastic job description. Of course, you might also get fired. But, you know, I hear there's still a lot of jobs in solar. So,
wait, so like, is the theory here that the description is just not adequate enough? So, like, if you set expectations correctly, people will stay in the job?
Absolutely.
But, like, your whole premise is that you can't adequately describe an experience. So, like,
well, I mean, they're never going to be able to get the experience from the description. No. You are confusing two very basic sociological terms here. You can't completely describe an experience. You can adequately describe an experience.
Oh, so that's what our issue is. It's not adequate. You don't think the embodied experience of being a pump jack worker will provide new knowledge or relevant knowledge to the turnover question?
No, I think an adequate description of what being a pump jack service engine technician or engineer or maintainer entails on a day-to-day basis, what that really entails, will help the turnover problem.
I think we need a union.
Or it will put this company out of business, one of the two. But anyways, either way, the problem will be solved.
Have you considered unionization?
I have considered it.
There you have it. I think we've answered this question. You can both fix your turnover problem and annoy your employees the anthropological way.
And more importantly, if you're going through Bakersfield, stop and have a bite.
Yeah.
And we're not even sponsored by the Bakersfield, Chamber of Commerce or Restaurant Association or anything, but they should. Yeah.
This episode of People Stuff is not brought to you by the Bakersfield Chamber of Commerce, though we wish it was.
Yeah, exactly. Okay. Well, speaking of annoying people the anthropological way, that's the end of this week's show. This week's show is brought to you by Robot Plumber. Sink leaking but can't get someone to look at it for 3 weeks? Fear not, Robot Plumber is here for you. fully automated plumbing for all those tough jobs, powered by AI and big data, the new version of Robot Plumber only hallucinates 20% of plumbing problems. Robot Plumber, it kind of works.
Robot Plumber, only get shit on 20% of your bathroom.
Well, that's it for people stuff. You can find all what we're up to at our website, www.people-stuff.com. Sign up for our newsletter, catch the latest episode, shop the merch store, become a member, and more. Thanks for listening. Until next time, I'm Michael.
And I'm Dan.
And you can find us in downtown Bakersfield eating our way from Luigi's The Pyrenees Cafe.
It's so funny.
People Stuff is a production of People Stuff, LLC. Production is by the fantastic Gabe Bullard. Music is by The Endless Bummer. Art is by Siobhan Hennigan. Marketing strategy by Brian Hout and John Florio. And expert legal assistance is provided by the Law Office of Matthew Schaefer, the one and only business uncle.